She's a developmental psychologist currently completing a postdoctoral research fellowship in adolescent and young adult medicine at Boston Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Her research investigates health disparities related to sexual orientation and gender identity in adolescents and young adults, sexual and gender identity development, and sexual fluidity. Dr. Wine.
Hello, thank you for having me. I'm going to be talking today about sexual orientation disparities in BMI. I have no financial relationships to disclose. The learning objectives for today's talk are to describe sexual orientation disparities in body mass index trajectories among adolescents and young adults, and to identify explanatory factors for these disparities. Previous research has found sexual orientation disparities in BMI that are modified by gender. Specifically, sexual minority females have a higher BMI and sexual minority males have a lower BMI compared to their same gender heterosexual counterparts. And in addition, the Growing Up Today study, a U.S. national cohort of youth, found that among males, gay males displayed smaller increases in BMI through adolescence and into young adulthood compared to heterosexuals. Although sexual orientation patterns in BMI have been established, the basis for these disparities remains to be explained. Sexual minority stress theory proposes that sexual minorities experience stressors related to the stigmatization of non-heterosexuality, and that these stressors produce negative health outcomes via a psychological stress response pathway. Previous research has found that sexual minorities are more likely than heterosexuals to experience extreme forms of stressors, such as victimization and child abuse, which can lead to negative physical and psychological health outcomes. One possible contributor to sexual orientation disparities in BMI is increased exposure among sexual minorities to stressors such as child abuse. Previous research indicated that childhood physical and sexual abuse is related to obesity in female and male adults across sexual orientation groups, and that exposure to violence in the home during childhood has been demonstrated to be related to greater likelihood of being overweight among adolescent females and males. And in addition, childhood sexual abuse partially explained disparities in obesity between lesbians and heterosexuals in a study of adult women. But it remains unclear whether child abuse explains sexual orientation disparities in BMI among males. Unhealthy weight-related behaviors, which may have obesogenic or leptogenic effects, may contribute to sexual orientation disparities in BMI. In the Growing Up Today study cohort, sexual minority females and males were more likely to report binge eating and purging compared to their heterosexual counterparts. And sexual minorities may use unhealthy weight-related behaviors, such as fast food consumption or calorie restriction, as a way of coping with stressors such as child abuse, leading to elevated or reduced BMI relative to heterosexuals. And female and male sexual minorities may use different weight-related behaviors in response to stressors, leading to gender differences in BMI disparities. So we propose a gender-modified stress pathway to sexual orientation disparities in BMI, such that stigma related to sexual orientation and gender nonconformity leads to sexual minority specific stressors, such as child abuse victimization, which leads to a stress response, such as unhealthy weight-related behaviors that are leptogenic or obesogenic, ultimately leading to elevated or reduced BMI. The aim of the current study was to explain the gender-bisexual orientation interaction in obesity, and to do this, we examined gender-stratified BMI trajectories by sexual orientation group and explored influences of child abuse history, weight-related behaviors, and sociodemographics on those trajectories. We hypothesized that child abuse would partially account for elevated BMI in sexual minority females, and that unhealthy weight-related behaviors would partially account for elevated BMI in sexual minority females and reduced BMI in sexual minority males compared to heterosexuals. The sample was taken from the Growing Up Today study, which we call the GUTS study, and this is a prospective cohort of children of women participating in the Nurses' Health Study 2. And we used survey data from 9 waves of data collection from 1996 to 2007, spanning the ages of 12 to 25 years. The sample size was close to 14,000 and was primarily female and white in ethnicity. The first predictor was sexual orientation, which was modeled based on the most recent report and back assigned to previous waves. The second predictor was child abuse history reported before age 11 years, and we created a severity score by combining multiple types of abuse, including emotional, physical, sexual, and witnessing physical and verbal abuse in the household. And the third predictor was weight-related behaviors, behavior trajectories that were obesogenic. Weight-related behaviors have been measured in numerous ways across the 9 waves of data collection in GUTS. So as a data reduction method and to accommodate the variability in waves in which particular behaviors were assessed, we used gender-stratified latent growth mixture model methods to capture participants' overall trajectory for each weight-related behavior, which were then used to categorize participants into groups, such as low, moderate, and high on a given behavior. The outcome was age-specific BMI calculated from self-reported height and weight, and the covariates were sociodemographics. Analyses were longitudinal using data across 9 waves from 1996 to 2007. Latent quadratic growth models used repeated measures of BMI across ages 12 to 25 years and adjusted for child abuse history and weight-related behavior trajectories. Models were gender stratified and accounted for intra-cluster correlation due to siblings and repeated measures. And the outcomes were BMI at age 17 years, which was the intercept, and 1 year change in BMI, which was the slope. And BMI at age 17 years was chosen to represent the intercept because age 17 was in the middle of the age range and this group had the highest number of observations. To give an overview of the latent quadratic growth models, model 1 included sexual orientation and sociodemographics, model 2 added child abuse history, and model 3 added obesogenic behavior trajectories. This figure shows results from latent quadratic growth models with females, which indicated that bisexuals had higher BMI at age 17 years and displayed greater 1 year increases in BMI compared to completely heterosexuals. And results from lesbians also indicated that 1 year change in BMI was similar in magnitude to bisexuals, but the coefficient was not significant for this group. And this figure shows results from latent quadratic growth models with males, which indicated no significant differences among sexual orientation groups in BMI at age 17 years, but gay males displayed smaller 1 year increases in BMI compared to completely heterosexuals. And in fact, by age 25 years, gay males had a BMI that was 2 units lower than completely heterosexuals. This table shows results for BMI at age 17 years among females. And as a reminder, these are linear regression results, so the null value is 0 rather than 1. The estimated difference between bisexual females and completely heterosexual females in BMI at age 17 years was attenuated by a small amount, 1.59 reduced to 1.46, but remained significant after controlling for level of child abuse and weight-related behaviors. This table shows results for 1 year change in BMI among females, and the estimated difference between bisexual females and completely heterosexual females in 1 year change in BMI was also attenuated by a small amount, but remained significant after controlling for level of child abuse and weight-related behaviors. This table shows the results for males for BMI at age 17 years. And as I mentioned regarding the figure, there were no significant differences among sexual orientation groups in BMI at age 17 years across the 3 models among males. And this table shows the results for 1 year change in BMI among males. And the estimated difference between gay males and completely heterosexual males in 1 year change in BMI was attenuated by a small amount, but remained significant after controlling for level of child abuse and weight-related behaviors. Sexual orientation disparities in BMI among females may be a consequence of using obesogenic weight-related behaviors as a coping mechanism in response to critical stressors such as child abuse victimization. A similar pattern was found for lesbians, but the differences were not significant. And we think this is probably because the sample size for lesbians was too small to have enough power to detect a significant difference, although it was trending in the same direction as bisexuals. Results from this study did not support a similar pathway for sexual minority males who also experienced higher rates of child abuse than heterosexuals but did not have elevated BMI. And we think that gender may modify the relationship between stressors and weight-related behaviors in sexual minorities due to gender differences in coping strategies. Some research has indicated that gay males do underreport their BMI by an estimated 0.37 units compared to heterosexual males. But in the current study, the difference between gay and completely heterosexual males' BMI at age 25 was much larger, as much as 2 units, which far exceeds the amount expected to be attributable to reporting bias. So we think there's a real difference going on there. And we believe that other unmeasured factors are likely related to sexual orientation disparities in BMI among males. A couple limitations to mention. The gut sample is very homogeneous in terms of race ethnicity. And there was some variability in the weight-related behavior assessments in terms of measuring different things at different waves and not measuring them consistently across all 9 waves. And we did try and address this by transforming the data into weight-related behavior trajectories. And finally, acknowledging a history of child abuse may be somewhat stigmatizing, so underreporting is potentially an issue. To summarize the findings, bisexual females had higher BMI at age 17 years and greater 1-year increases in BMI compared to completely heterosexual females. Sexual minority males did not have lower BMI at age 17 years compared to heterosexual males, but gay males did have smaller 1-year increases in BMI. And these patterns largely confirm previous research demonstrating gendered sexual orientation disparities in BMI. And our study findings extend this literature by documenting that among female youth, elevated BMI in bisexuals is partly explained by disparities in child abuse and obesogenic weight-related behaviors. Some implications of this work are that healthcare providers working with youth should be aware of higher BMI and increases in BMI among bisexual females and heterosexual males, and that weight control and obesity prevention programs need to be sensitive to the needs of all sexual orientation groups. I'd like to acknowledge the Division of Adolescent and Young Adult Medicine at Boston Children's Hospital and the SOGI Working Group and our funders. Thank you.
Thank you, and I want to thank one more time our speakers for staying within the determined time limit that now leaves us with plenty of time for questions. So I'd like to open the floor to questions.
For
self-reported.
Okay.
And so in our paper we talk about potential underreporting.
Oh, sure.
Unfortunately, the mic doesn't move.
The mic is tied to the pole. Sex researcher. So the question was, did we actually have a metric or a follow-up question to ascertain whether participants had a blatant exposure of work discrimination or if it was self-reported? And the measure is self-reported. This is actually a critique in the discrimination literature that it actually is usually underreported because a lot of youth may not even realize that they didn't get the job because somebody made a stereotype, right? So it's something that we need to work towards and kind of figure out perhaps other metrics, including observational studies of when it's happening and qualitative inquiry into it, but yeah.
Can you guys hear me?
I can yank it out of here, maybe. Nope.
I think that's fine.
So, sorry I did not clarify that in my presentation, but yes, we did define unprotected sex as sexual intercourse without a condom, and we did define unprotected sexual intercourse as just, or we did compute those variables only taking into account vaginal and anal intercourse as well.
So let me see if I can remember it.
Why men?
Oh, so the question was, why did we explicitly look at men? Well, the study was actually funded to look at the structural conditions affecting HIV vulnerability among young men who have sex with men, and so it curtailed the gender in that regard. We have other studies in the center that look at sexual minority women and their psychosocial processes and health behaviors. Do we have that question for in MSAS? I'm looking at my project director. Yeah, we can look. So if we have it, I'd be happy to have it, you know, send it over to you.
So we did define culturally competent care as the ability of providers to be aware of the literature and the appropriate and specific care that LGBT individuals should be receiving based on their gender and sexual orientation. It's part of the larger issue is that many providers don't even ask about sexual orientation or the construct of the family unit for people that are LGBT. So it's part of an even larger conversation about just the clinical care. It's talking about risk behaviors for both men and women who their partners are when specific sexual behaviors, use of alcohol and other substances that may increase one's risk to participate in risky sexual behavior. But it's also looking at risk factors around cardiovascular disease or cancer, for example. We don't have very much information about specific risk, the prevalence or incidence in particular of breast cancer among a lesbian or bisexual women. But we know that the likelihood of having children, it remains lower. The rates of being obese, the prevalence of obesity is higher. Smoking, alcohol use are higher. So there's a hypothetical increased risk. And so for providers to be able to talk about those risks for heart disease, for cancer is also really important.
Okay, so if I remember this correctly. So the first question was about whether we looked at other health measures other than BMI? Yeah, I think that's a great question. The GUTS survey does measure a lot of different health measures that we didn't happen to include in this particular analysis. But I do think that it would be really important to look at other correlating health outcomes, and we're doing other analyses that take into account other mental health issues as well. I can't remember your second question.
Whether you measured
BMI in categories or
underweight.
So BMI was calculated in the study based on the CDC percentages for youth, the percentiles for youth. So it does take into account the lower and upper ranges of BMI. So it's not just mean BMI over time. It categorizes people into percentiles. And then But we did end up using raw BMI for this analysis. Yeah. I don't know if that answers your question very well. But
I think she was asking whether you looked to see what the difference was between heterosexual and bisexual or lesbian, and for gay men, heterosexual and gay men. But what about the proportion of people that were actually underweight?
Yeah, like it's another...
within the subgroups. Yeah, we didn't do that in this particular analysis, but I think that would be especially interesting to look at with gay males since they do have the lower BMI. Yeah, that's a great future direction. Thanks.
We had a question in the back.
So just to clarify, you asked me to kind of clarify or give any examples or reasons that I think there may be that difference in between partners?
Yes, your thoughts on why.
Okay. I think that has to do with a number of different issues. It may have to do with a performance of gender that may be different with their male partners than their female partners. It may be because they want to have a greater level of intimacy with their female partners, and that be something that's really great for us to look into in future analysis with this data. Unfortunately, I don't think we have much in this data set to look at in those terms, but I do think those are probably a couple of explanations for why that difference maybe exists. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
All right, thank you.
Don't go away.
Okay. And I will bring up again that we did recruit men who were engaging in sexually risky behaviors. So one recruitment or eligibility requirement was unprotected sex. So that takes into account why we did have probably a greater number of men having unprotected sex with female partners. Also, one thing that we didn't have a chance to do in our study was look at differences between main female partners and main male partners or non-main partners. And that's just because I think our definition of main partners was a little weird. So we did have people reporting a large number of main partners and a lot of concurrent partners. So in this analysis, we did not take that into account. But as I said, we did require them to have at least one episode of unprotected sex. But you're right, that would be a really great discussion to go into.
So the question was, in terms of either defining cultural competency or the development of programs around cultural competency for, we'll say, medical students and other affiliated medical providers, or even people that have are in residency or are fully licensed, who really has the responsibility of setting up training programs? And the AAMC actually is relatively open-minded to this, but it's not a priority measure. Although they did put together a working group about a year and a half ago because they wanted to be able to talk about what's being done around the country after the Stanford UCSF article came out, where there was a complete mismatch between what medical students were reporting in terms of their training around LGBT cultural competency and what deans were reporting. The students reported far less exposure in medical school. I think GLAMA, the Gay and Lesbian Medical Association, thank you, and the Human Rights Campaign. The Human Rights Campaign is headquartered in Washington, D.C., and they put out what's called the Health Equality Index, the HEI, and this actually is a measure for hospitals to complete in terms of whether they provide, some examples are, do they have sensitive wording in their non-discrimination policies? Do they specifically identify same-gender partners as being part of a family unit when they're talking about what's family? So a very broad description. And I'm very sad to say that prior to earlier this year, UCLA had failed the survey, not because we weren't sensitive, but because there was some very specific wording that HRC was looking for. We subsequently have passed, but that also was a broad discussion, not just at UCLA, but in the Southern California area, with assistance from other advocacy groups. But GLAMA right now is working on it, but AAMC is also working on it. The AMA, if we were looking at the broader professional organization, doesn't have much interest, but does sponsor some student groups. The goal is within the next couple of years to have some standardized educational components that are available for institutions to select, and then to be able to put in place so that, we can be training and actually be culturally competent providers. So one of the things that we actually didn't do was ask for their curriculum. And in the question about do you have a comprehensive curriculum, some or none, we specifically didn't want it to be dichotomous, just as a yes-no. We wanted to give those institutions that perceived they had some LGBT training, but it wasn't really comprehensive. And I think that was important and it was in terms of moving the conversation forward. We have some descriptions in terms of the open-ended questions, but we don't have examples of the curriculum. The study was actually done anonymously in terms of who responded, because both our IRB and in talking to community advocates as we were developing the study, they were very concerned that the people responding to the survey might in some situations, more geographically or the type of institution, feel that they couldn't respond openly. Both they might feel very uncomfortable saying they didn't have a program, but they might equally feel uncomfortable saying there was interest in having a program or there was one person or a few people who really were LGBT competent and that the administration in that particular institution wouldn't be supportive of those particular opinions. I think the comments highlighted some of those. But what the AAMC is doing and what GLAMA has done to some degree, and UCLA is also working on it, is to try and survey and get all examples, if not the specifics, of all of these trainings so that they can be made available and that particular institutions may say, oh, you know, this particular training feels like it would be right for us, or this particular method of training. You know, some of the trainings are in person. Again, the HEI actually requires training for managers, and so the HRC has online training that's available. GLAMA has a multi-part online training around gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual individuals. And there is a movement, I'm happy to say, in many academic medical settings to really hone these skills for our trainees and for ourselves to be able to provide excellent and equitable care.
We still have some time.
So UCLA has a National Center of Excellence in Women's Health. I've always been interested in LGBT health since I was a Robert Wood Johnson clinical scholar at UCLA, starting in the mid-90s. There are other researchers at UCLA as well, Susan Cochran, Vicky Mays, and then Susan and Ninez Ponce have done, as I have, done work with the California Health Interview Survey, which is a population-based survey of the non-institutionalized adults, adolescents, and children in the state. So I'm also in contact with the folks at UCSF who truly do have a center of excellence in lesbian health and have for a number of years. So whether we become an actual center of excellence, we've always had a strong focus on LGBT health. We have others doing health around gay men and bisexual men. So whether we take on that label or not, people are very interested, very well accepted by our organization. And I had met with the head of our health system last December to go over the HEI, the Health Equality Index, some of the work that I've done, some of the work that I do in terms of the medical student perceptions and knowledge and how we've been improving their training around LGBT. And he was very, very excited and really questioned why we hadn't been doing more earlier. So that's the kind of reception you want to get and motivates us to just continue.
Any other questions? Any other questions? If not, I'd like to give another round of applause to our wonderful speaker. Thank you, everybody.